Okay, so this today is Monday, November 20th, 2023, and this is an interview with Dr. Nikki Kolodny as a continuation from her presentation in my class this morning at Carleton University. I'm Megan Tibbetts-Lamarand, and thank you, Nikki, for being here.
It's my pleasure, really.
Yeah, so I guess the first thing, what should I ask first? One thing that I didn't get a chance to ask while you were presenting to my class is you were talking about how from working at the clinic in Toronto, you were already kind of a public figure and being sort of harassed by anti-choice activists. But you then made the decision to kind of become even more public and start speaking, in the media and traveling across Canada, speaking to different media outlets. So, what was it like to make that decision to go even more public?
Well, it was hard because I'm not a na I wasn't a natural at public speaking. I wasn't really particularly good at it. I was okay, but it wasn't a strength of mine the way it is for some people. So I really had to learn some of it. But to me, it felt like part of the reason that I had made the decision to work at the Morgenthaler Clinic and to help out by providing services to women was also to help build the movement. Some of the leaders of OCAC thought that having a woman provider would help strengthen and build and widen the support for repealing the abortion law, which was really important to do because women were really suffering. And also, it was like just so wrong. It was our bodies, and we shouldn't have had so many hoops to jump through in order to make the decisions that women wanted to make. So part of that was public speaking, and I did some of it. I did most of it locally. I did some national CBC stuff, and I spoke at some of the rallies, and then Dr. Morgenthaler, aka Henry, was often would take trips across the country and speak at various cities to garner support for the repeal of the law. And once I went with him, and once Carolyn Egan and I went on our own to do a similar thing. But it seemed like it was part of the job. If I was going to do it, then that was part of it.
Were you trained in public speaking? Was that something that was part of the strategy meetings or anything like that?
Not really. I mean, I did get help from Linda Gardner and Bob Gardner and Carolyn Egan and Judy Rebick. All tried to give me pointers and tried to help me figure out how to do things. But everybody was really busy, and training me to do abortions was more important than training me to do public speaking. And some of it came easily, but a lot of it didn't.
Right. So it was just sort of a trial and
It
error
is.
almost for some of this
It
stuff.
was. Yeah, you could kind of, you I mean, I could tell when it wasn't working, and then I could go, what did I do wrong, you know? And I tried not doing a lot of preparation ahead of time. That did not work well. I tried preparing a lot ahead of time. That didn't work well either. So I needed to have a balance of a kind of a skeleton that also just allowed me to speak. But I was like, I was in knots at that time of my life. You know, I didn't have that easygoing ability to talk about myself that I have now. I was, you know, I was struggling to do the best I could with I had my own I'm a family doctor. I had my own family practice with the work at the clinic, which was becoming more and more parenting a young child, a relationship, and doing movement work, which was meetings that were important, and I was learning from the meetings. And then the undercurrent of violence also kind of made me very kind of soldier. I was soldiering on, you know, which made it kind of hard to really talk more about myself. And I think if I'd been able to talk more about myself when I spoke, I would have been a better public speaker, but I was reticent to do that. It was too hard.
And maybe given, like, that there could be anti-choice people in the audience, did you feel like you had walls up in a sense?
Absolutely. I mean, just the threat of verbal attack, the threat of physical attack was always present for good reason, because both of them happened all the time.
Did you have a sense when you went to these speaking engagements about whether the crowd was going to be mostly pro-choice, mostly anti-choice? Was it just kind of a feeling that you would get when you got there?
Well, most times we knew ahead of time. We would know who was coming and how hard we had worked to keep it just us, and how hard we hadn't worked to do that, and what was likely to, if it was another city, then the local activists would tell us who was likely to be there. And we developed tactics along those lines, depending on who was there and not there.
Right.
I'll tell you a funny story about learning on the job. One time, I don't know why I ended up doing this, but there was a press conference at Queen's Park sometime after something had happened at the clinic. I don't recall what it was. It wasn't a major thing. It was kind of a small thing. And it got decided that I would chair the press conference. I don't know if I said, I've never done this, I should try, or if somebody said, she hasn't tried yet, give her that to do. I really don't know how it happened. But I was doing that, and the Queen's Park press corps was all out there. Oh, Bob Ray had come in, and he had endorsed something, and he was by my side, and that was part of it. So they all asked their questions, and one person asked a second question, and I said, sorry, I'll come back to you. The way we did it in our meetings is nobody got to ask two questions until everybody else had their piece. Well, apparently, they had a rule at the press corps that you never stop a question from, and it was like a major press person who was doing this. So they all got up and started to walk out, which is what they did in circumstances like that. And then Bob, and I'm going, and I'm saying, oh my God, what did I do? And talk about lack of training, right? And Bob Ray said, hold it. She didn't mean that. Don't worry about it. Come on back. I'll answer your question, blah, blah, blah. And then it was all, and I just stood back, and Judy Rebbit came and finished the rest of it, thank God. It was like, I mean, that was one of the worst things that happened, but it was definitely a learning on the job experience.
Yeah. So when you were going and sort of traveling to other cities to mentor them on opening up abortion clinics and things like that, could you say which cities you went to, and then how did you choose those specific places?
Yeah, so the places were really chosen by OCAC. They were, the public speaking tour I did with Karen was all organized, which cities we were going to go to. And at various points along the way, trying to garner support for repeal of the law, and also talking to the local activists and sometimes physicians, but mostly activists, about whether it would be possible for them to also open up another freestanding clinic to challenge the law. And most of them were really interested in doing that, but weren't sure they could. And so one of the things I did was really talk to them about what would they would need in place, the kind of coalitions they'd have to have ahead of time, and laying it out and saying if they could do it, it'd be good, you know, and if they could do it and sustain it, I would find them a doctor, you know. I wanted to take that out of the equation, because sometimes they felt they needed the doctor first, and actually it's backwards. You need the support first, because if you don't have the support, the doctor's in peril. You know, really, license gone, maybe in jail, you know, bad. So you have the support, they're not likely to touch the doctor. I mean, Henry, of course, took the biggest risks, and he was the He was the icebreaker for all of us. By the time I worked at the Morgenthaler Clinic, it was pretty clear that I would not lose my license. I knew I might get, that I would probably get arrested and spend time in jail, possibly. But I also knew I wouldn't lose my license. But anyway, I'm digressing. So we did that in a whole variety of different cities. Most of them had already started thinking about doing this. Like it was out in the ether, you know, it was the movement. And it was a national movement.
So they had kind of their own local groups of activists.
Absolutely.
Already.
Absolutely.
And so where did you, so you said, I think in class, Kitchener, Waterloo.
So after 88, I helped start clinics in Kitchener and in Peterborough.
Okay.
But that was after 88.
That was after 88. Okay.
It was, yes.
Prior to 88, was that when trying to open the BC clinic? Was
yes.
that prior to 88?
Yes.
And Alberta, was that prior to 88?
Yeah, the meetings about that were all prior to 88. Yeah.
Okay. But those clinics didn't open till
after? BC didn't open. As far as I know, BC didn't open until after 88. But they came really close to doing it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it didn't happen. They wanted to wait to see what happened with the most recent Supreme Court decisions.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I remember I read that the premier was, like,
yes.
extremely against it.
That's right. I've forgotten that. So a lot of work for nothing, maybe. So I think there was very good support. The trade union movement was in support of it, the women's movement. There was a lot of support in BC.
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised because BC is
yes.
quite progressive.
Yes, yes. And there are a lot of doctors who went out on a limb with the mifepristone and methotrexate and all of that a little bit later, you know, but
mm-hmm.
yeah, no, good people out there.
I think it was just the premier's, like, personal
yeah.
vendetta
yeah.
or personal beliefs.
Yes.
Did you ever try to go out the other way, out east?
Yes. Well, so did I actually speak out east? I can't remember that. I might have. But I did mentor another doc in Toronto. She worked at my clinic, and she was one of the founders of the outpatient women's center abortion services in Halifax, but not till after 88.
Mm-hmm.
After 88, it happened.
Did some of these local clinics, like even after 88, because I know that the Toronto clinic was so besieged
yes.
by anti-choice activists, and maybe you can tell some more stories about that after.
Yeah.
But after 88, did some of the local clinics in smaller places still have to deal with that kind of constant picketing
yes.
and attack?
Yes. 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 I mean, some, I think of the anti-choice as kind of, it's got, at least in terms of the people who are in your face at your facility, there's kind of the core, and then there's this, like, I don't know, the rings of Saturn or something on the outside. And they tend to drop away if they're worried about being arrested, if there isn't the whole popular support, if the law has changed. They dropped away.
Mm-hmm.
But the core of really vitriolic people never really changed much.
Right, and they
yes.
were very widespread, I
they
suppose.
Were. They were. The NDP came in to government in Ontario shortly after. I won't remember the date, but it wasn't long after the repeal. And they made a big difference. They enforced the laws about keeping people a distance from the clinic. They actually
mm-hmm.
arrested a couple people, which kept a whole lot of other people not coming. You know, they were prepared to come, but they didn't want to be arrested, so they didn't come. So it made a very big difference. They used to bus, the Catholic schools used to bus students to demonstrate outside the clinic once a week. That stopped also. I don't know what happened to make it stop.
Mm-hmm.
Things got a lot better. Yeah, and then, of course, we got OHIP. We got patients
yeah.
covered by OHIP, which was marvelous. It's really just as important as the law being repealed, really.
I guess with the, like, yeah, bubble zone legislation around the clinics, maybe that's why the Catholic schools stopped busing them in.
Yes, maybe. Because
they couldn't get up as close anymore.
Yeah, they couldn't get as close.
So, yeah, what were some of the things that you had to deal with anti-choice groups doing at the Toronto clinic? I know, like, common knowledge is kind of that it was firebombed a couple of times.
It was.
But what were some other tactics that you experienced?
Yeah. Well, neither patients nor staff could get into the clinic without walking through them. And they would just hurl baby killer and we're going to get you when you're not looking and, you know, we know your son's school and blah, 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 things like that. I imagine that some things that go on now are worse. But anyway, it was pretty bad. I didn't love it. And, you know, you work in a place that has a bomb shelter in the backyard. You know that the bomb shelter's there. It affects you. You try and wall everything off to be there for your patients. And that's what the staff was wonderful. Everybody tried to do that and was pretty successful at it. But everybody got that kind of harassment. I had a friend who was a physician who came. There were a group of doctors for choice, and for some reason, a few of us were at the Morgenthaler Clinic one day, and we were on the front steps, and somebody sprayed like an atomizer or something under her nose and said, "I hope this kills your baby." And I'm like, "That's disgusting." She was very pregnant at the time. And it was terrible. It was just terrible.
Also very ironic.
Yes, very ironic. Yes, very true. Very true.
Yeah, and you were saying something earlier about, like, the use of some kind of acid to try and get in.
Oh, yes. So while I was there, I think there were two different instances where they tried to get in through the skylight. But the one I remember most is that it was not during working hours, so everybody was safe. But they used some kind of acid to get through the plastic of the the skylight. And they came through and they damaged a bunch of the equipment. But it was not nice.
Yeah, I guess maybe that was their goal, was to damage the equipment.
Yes, scare us too.
Yeah.
Yeah, this could happen to you, you know, but damage the equipment. Yeah, because it took a little while to get everything back so procedures could be performed safely. Not long, though. Turnaround time was always quick. We just managed. It's part of the thing. Don't let it stop.
Right. don't let them know that they've gotten to you kind of thing.
Yes. Women get served. Women get what they need. That's what we're about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Can you tell the story about the donuts?
Yes, yes. So one of the things, the anti-choice, there's a laneway behind the clinic, and a lot of times staff and patients would come in the back way because usually there weren't as many anti-choice out back. But they would patrol and offer donuts to patients coming in. And patients had to have nothing in their stomachs in order to get the procedure safely because of the pain medication we used for them. And so once they had the donut, they couldn't get the procedure that day. And they knew that very well. And they offered them donuts. And it didn't stop women. I mean, women would just rebook and come in, you know, again another time. But it meant that their childcare, their work, everything had to be rescheduled. And it made things hard for them. And I guess they thought they really were going to stop them. But most women, having made up their mind, don't stop. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you feel like at the time that it was just a very loud minority and that the majority of people were pro-choice? Or was there an effort to make it so that the majority of people were pro-choice?
I would say it shifted. I mean, and it depended province by province. Like, Alberta, it was very different. Alberta had a majority, you know, like 60% didn't think it should be legal and didn't want to repeal the law. Ontario, I think it was 47 at the beginning or something like that. And you know, but it really didn't take long of popularizing the effects of that abortion law by making women wait so long that Canada had the highest mid-trimester abortion rate of industrialized nations, and women had to have multiple appointments, and some provinces said yes easily and some provinces didn't, and people were having to travel, and it was really bad. And the more the movement made that clear, it shifted a lot, and it shifted pretty quickly to 60% in Ontario from, you know, I don't know, I mean, the numbers are probably all available, but you just had the sense. I certainly had the sense when I was working at the Morgenthaler Clinic that I was riding the crest of not only the popular movement, but the country's majority.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that the law was standing in the way of women's right to decide themselves what to do with their bodies. You know?
Yeah, it's not often that you, like, I study the history of social movements, and it's not often that you can look back at a movement and be like, that was successful, like, that got
right.
what they wanted, even though it took a really long time. So I'm curious
that is so true.
What do you think is, like, how were they so effective? Like,
yes.
What was so effective at changing? Because it's one thing to change the law, but it's another thing to kind of change a majority opinion or have people sort of realize, oh, hey, women should have bodily autonomy, right?
Yes.
So how do you think they were so effective at doing that?
I think that they, that's a good question. And it's really true. It was a time of take-backs, not really of winning things. And that was a huge win, a really huge win. And I think it was because of all of first of all, it was the leadership of OCAC. I said this in the class today, but I really think that the leadership of Judy Brebeck, Carolyn Egan, Bob Gardner, Linda Gardner, and the people who came, there were other people who were part of that, who came and went, who added tremendously. But that core provided such strong leadership over years. And there were enough people came to meetings once a week to do the work. And the work of outreach in terms of coalition building. So coalition is, I don't agree with your organization about this, this, and that, but we both support the repeal of this law, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so let's work together. And, I mean, I know you call that something else now. Coalition building is, anyway, but... Say it out. Intersectionality. Thank you very much. intersectionality, I think, is that's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And OCAC sent people everywhere, you know, into the unions, into the Y, into the workplaces, public campaigns, having people speak out about how horrible their experiences had been before the law or
mm-hmm.
even when the law was in effect, but they couldn't access the services that were available because they were so pitifully available. It was a public campaign that worked and it just hit the resonance of people, men and women, and to have that law repealed. I'm not sure all of them believed in the bodily integrity part the way they do now. I think there has been a shift, a much bigger shift
mm-hmm.
towards bodily integrity now. But I think back then it really was about choice. What? They can't choose? This law is interfering this way? That doesn't seem right. You know, so it should be a choice between a woman and her doctor. It wasn't really bodily integrity for the majority of people yet. I don't think so. But it shifted in terms of that's a bad law. That's a bad law. And some of them might have thought there should be some law. You know, it's
mm-hmm.
it's good they could never get enough agreement to pass another law, which is awfully fortunate.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
But the fact that this law was wrong is what really united the movement, and so it worked.
Yeah, because I know there were some efforts to kind of, after the law was repealed, to get it more, but like a more nuanced version.
Yes.
But yeah, there could never be, there was never any consensus on what that should be.
I think the anti-choice helped us there. They just opposed it so badly. Anything that the pro-choice people tried to cobble together still couldn't get a majority because of the anti-choice, so nothing
happened.
Because they
were so extreme.
They were.
Yeah.
So that was
funny.
It is funny, but it worked to our benefit in that instance, and it obviously works very well. There's no need for a law. A doctor has to be licensed to practice medicine. That's all you need in terms of laws for that.
Yeah, I guess when I look back at the records, it also seems like there was an effort to make abortion into like a humanitarian issue where
mm-hmm.
women are the victims of this law. Because the anti-choice had like, oh, you know, the fetuses are victims of abortion, right?
Yes.
But I feel like there was efforts from the pro-choice side to say like, hey, like
mm-hmm.
women are being hurt by this and dying.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Oh, and let me just correct this, because I said doctor's license, but it's not just doctors, because midwives and nurse practitioners and physician assistants, all of them are quite able and should be within their scope of practice also. Yeah.
Do you remember what it was like to provide like the first abortion that you provided before the law was repealed?
I'm laughing. You can't see my face on this audio, but I'm laughing. I think I remember that first week. It was really terrifying. I wasn't really adequately trained. I should have had more cases under my belt supervised. And it was hard, but you know, inside the clinic, I felt safe.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel, you know, it was just me struggling with my skills. I didn't feel afraid because I was doing something illegal. I felt afraid because I wanted to make sure I was careful and safe. And I was, but I was afraid about it. So I remember how tremulous I felt about doing the first cases. And I think I started this story in the class, but I never finished it, about the gynae I met, the gynecologist I met at some fundraising thing. And I asked him, I said, if I have a complication, can I send them to you? And because you can't do a surgical procedure without having, even though it's so safe, without sometimes having a complication. And he said to me, you know, you can't do a surgical procedure without having complications sometime, and yes, you can send them. And that was wonderful. That made my day. That made my first week so much better. And I didn't need him. It was fine.
Mm-hmm.
But until that point, because Henry was in Montreal when I was in Toronto. We took turns. So I couldn't turn to him. And knowing that I did have a doc at one of the Toronto hospitals who would back me was very important, because it wasn't obvious that any of them would.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's good to have that
support
network, like you said, once again.
Yes.
Did you feel like you were committing crimes?
No. Because I didn't. I never did. Because it wasn't a crime. The law was the crime.
Mm-hmm.
Really. I didn't feel like I was committing a crime. Yeah.
So did the like, I don't know, moral needling of the anti-choice ever get to you? Or were you sort of just like, I know that what I'm doing is the right thing?
I felt in my bones that it's a woman's body.
Mm-hmm.
It's a woman's body. And women are moral agents. Women are responsible moral agents. I mean, we don't even require a license to be a parent. You know, and that's one of the most important things in a society is raising children. And we don't require anything to become a parent. Why in the world would we restrict whether or not to carry a pregnancy to term?
Mm-hmm.
It's absurd. really. So I never felt wrong about that, ever. Yeah. I mean, I was sorry for women's anguish. I mean, not all of them were anguish, but many of them were, and that was hard. I was glad I had my therapy training, you know. I was able to use two worlds for patients, but women were usually sure what they were doing and why.
Did you do any kind of, like, because I know that they had specific counselors at
yes.
these clinics, but did you kind of feel like you were doing any sort of counseling role?
Yeah. So the demand was so high at the Toronto Moore and Crowler Clinic, and the counselors were really quite skilled. So by the time they got to me, unless there was really somebody was in extremis or either very upset or very conflicted,
mm-hmm.
it wasn't fair to the next patient to spend much time talking with the patient I had. I did it sometimes because it was very important to me that consent was clear. It was very important to me that the woman was as clear as she could be.
Mm-hmm.
And if there was any question about that, I would take time. And if they were really upset or very young, I would always take time. But the counselors, by the time they got to me in the way that clinic worked, they were well sorted out.
They'd already been counseled.
They were well sorted out,
yeah.
Now, that was one of the issues that led the group of us that formed Choice and Health Clinic, which I helped found.
What year was that?
I think it was 88. I think it was later in 88, right after decision, not long after decision. Yeah, at the end of the year, maybe. Yeah. And that was one of the issues. We wanted more time for counseling. We wanted more time for everything for women. I mean, there was a demand for services. It's true, but we wanted more time. And we wanted to make sure there was translation for every language. And yeah, the Women's Immigrant Center helped us do that.
Yeah, that was one of my students' questions that she didn't get
yes.
to ask, that
oh,
she emailed me. Was sort of, because she remembered you saying, like, doctors who had immigrated, like, that were scared of being deported.
Yes,
so
that's
they,
right.
So they wouldn't, you know, maybe wouldn't be performing abortions. But she was wondering, like, especially in somewhere as multicultural as Toronto, how were you guys able to accept patients, like, with a language barrier?
Yeah. The Immigrant Women's Center, IW... Immigrant Women's... Anyway, they helped a lot. They would get somebody on the phone with us. They would find somebody. I mean, if we knew ahead of time, we could schedule with them. But they could always find somebody in the right language. And we would just do it by phone and make sure the person understood, that they were able to be reassured in their language.
That's amazing.
It was wonderful. And that they had clear explanations of what to expect and what not to worry about in spite of what they've been told. That's a large part of counseling for abortion stuff. People come in with such wrong information a lot of the time.
Right.
Yeah, so a lot of it is, no, it's not. I mean, it's safer than childbirth, and childbirth is very safe, and this is safer than that.
Mm-hmm.
So, oh, you know, there's just a lot of misinformation still about that. Yeah.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of propaganda that the anti-choice produces,
they
for
do.
Sure.
They do. They get the loud voices.
Yeah, I'm just so interested in, like, these kind of women in the background, like, answering phones, making photocopies, and, you know,
yes.
that are just so necessary to the movement, but don't
yes.
really get talked about. So, like, yeah, the Immigrant Women's Center being able to find someone in any language to, like, talk on the phone, I mean, that's so crucial, right?
Yeah, well, the work they did was... And I'm still I don't know. I'm out of touch. But, I mean, they were autonomous. They were there before us, and they were there after us. I mean, they do wonderful work
mm-hmm.
in terms of providing healthcare and education and support, and they're a wonderful place. And we were very lucky and happy to have them be interested in working with us.
Yeah, also there's a misconception that the abortion movement was like a white women's thing. So
yeah.
I
Well, it mostly was.
Yeah.
It not entirely, but it mostly was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In
yeah.
terms of, I guess,
the leadership
of the movement.
Yeah,
like
not
that.
In terms of who came out or
mm-hmm.
who told stories, you know, but the leadership itself was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Both CAREL and OCAC were fairly white. Some Asian, some Aboriginal.
But I guess it's sometimes to put yourself in a sort of public and risky position, it takes some privilege, like, can help with that, right?
Yes. Well, yes. But sometimes it can work the other way, too. For me, that was true. I had the privilege and I had the MD license, you know, that's mm-hmm. Many times when I thought of stopping, I didn't. I don't mean thought of stopping being a provider. I mean thought of leaving med school. That's a conversation for another topic. But that is a lot of privilege and security. But sometimes people who live close to the bone are close to survival are also very functionally rebellious.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like they don't have as much to lose, so they can provide the leadership.
Right.
Right? It's true. They can and do in many different social movements around the world. So, I mean, I certainly saw that in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I love that story that you told in class.
That was very important to me.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And the kids throwing the rocks at the tanks. Yeah. I mean, that's such an
amazing
image.
And then the turret goes to the kid, you know. They don't, the kid scurries away, but the turret moves its point right around to where the kid was.
Yeah, it's just really cool that those kids were like role models for you in a way.
They still are. Yeah. It is. Well, it's all around the world, resistance. Some things are bad and have to be fought.
So did you ever feel like giving up, like not because you thought what you were doing was wrong, but just because it was so fraught, like so much harassment? Did you ever feel like, oh, I just don't want to deal with this anymore?
I was very worried. I think the thing that made me feel sometimes like, what am I doing this for, is the internal... some of the internal, I'll say fighting, friction or criticisms or displacement. That was hardest. But the anti-choice never made me feel like fighting. I was not going to ever let them.
Mm-hmm.
I just felt like if I stop, I'll stop for my own reasons, but never because of them.
Right. Never because of that harassment.
Never because of that. Nope.
Are you willing to talk about some of the internal conflicts?
Well, you know, solidarity is important. It gets driven into you. I know it's at some point it's important to understand that, well, any movement has its struggles, its friction, not just around policy, but also around personalities and power struggles and all kinds of nonsense that happen within movements. And I was unfortunately part of the focus of some of that. I wasn't welcomed by all of the pro-choice movement. While I was kind of recruited to be a feminist provider as a model and as a way to build the movement, there were others that really thought that wasn't necessary. There were others in the national movement who thought that really wasn't necessary, and why were we bringing somebody else in? And there was a question about whether the defense fund would pay for my legal fees after I was charged, and they did, but it didn't feel very good that there was that hesitancy, and I don't know. There were a lot of politics within my own clinic eventually that made me very unhappy and sad. But I always replaced people to take my place as I inched out. So, and I did inch out, really. I left the clinic in really good hands and I left. So.
When did you leave how long did you have the Choice in Health clinic?
Well,
and when did you leave?
It was never really mine. It was a collective to start with. We founded it as a co-op. And then there were arguments about how to manage the finances of it. I had my house on it. And there was a faction that didn't want to raise fees, even though we were in the hole.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I'm sorry, we have to do this, my house. This did not go over well because there's class dynamics. you know, right. doctor. And, you know, I learned not to be the big cheese doctor in terms of really being comfortable in a collective with decision making. Like, it was really wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And I took it over and they left and it continued on.
Yeah, it's still around.
Yes, it is. Debbie Copes. Yeah, it is. Yeah. So it continued. I left in 2000, but I left to be with Joanna.
Oh, so that's why you went back to the U.S.
That's why I went back to the U.S. to live with my partner, yeah.
But continued to work at, like, Planned Parenthood.
I did.
All those things.
Yep, I had for a while I was under a grant with a doc in Manhattan she had a bunch of money to train the trainer for family practice residencies. So the idea was to train the people in high positions, educators in family medicine, and then they could train their own residents, and then there'd be generation after generation of residents. So that was wonderful, and I got to train a bunch of neat people and they're still doing all that.
Yeah, and then that's
grant,
amazing.
It was good. And then the grant money ran out, and I started working at a couple different Planned Parenthoods, and that was good. That was fine.
Was there a different, I mean, were you still, like, after 1988 in Canada, was there still harassment and picketing of clinics, and was that similar when you went to the United States, or did that change?
Yeah, it lessened. I'm not sure I would have picked the place. I picked the places I went to that there was little or no picketing. I was kind of getting burnt out. Maybe I was already burnt out, actually. There were anti-choice people at Choice in Health, especially in the beginning, but they hardly at all. For one, we were in a medical building. So there were many offices, so they couldn't be in front of our place. And so it wasn't as satisfying for them. And also, the Morin Tata Clinic was just always the focus
Because he was the sort of figurehead.
Yeah, he was the popular figurehead, the icebreaker, the one who took all the risks to start with, and put so much of his life on the line for it. And they went there, so they didn't come to us as often, and
right.
That was fine. I liked that.
Yeah.
I liked that. And so I guess after 88, it just decreased over time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the harassment and the fears. But there's still that, like, I had enough name recognition that I felt on guard in Toronto. I did. It was a comfort to leave in some ways, where people didn't know me. I could just come in, go out. It was much better for me.
Did you feel any kind of, like, trepidation or worry about, like, me asking you to come tell your story and that being maybe, like, a more public name in the archives again?
Not in the archives at all, but I did. Actually, I didn't think about it at all. I was just pleased to come. And then I was talking to a buddy of mine in Toronto who knew me back then, also was peripherally involved in the choice movement. And she said, well, make sure you have her check about security. And I thought, oh, I didn't even think of that. Right? So that's why I asked you, and I was glad you had thought about it. But no, I don't. I'm not too concerned now about that.
It's such a different environment
now.
It is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's always the people, like, shouting on the street corner with some gruesome signs. I don't know if they'll ever go away, but...
Are they still there? Oh, my goodness.
Occasionally.
Yes.
Yeah, occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see... I know some of my students were kind of, like, weirdly, they're more familiar with the American abortion politics because of the fall of Roe v. Wade and everything like that.
Yes.
But do you see, I guess I'm wondering if you see that being, like, something people should be worried about in Canada, that abortion could be recriminalized, or, I mean, it just doesn't have the same like religious right here, maybe? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I think the religious right is here. Not some, in some provinces more than others, but I don't know. I guess vigilance. I think it's always, I'm shocked that it was reversed. I would never have predicted in the United States that it was reversed.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible. But they had a particular goal in mind and they worked towards it and over 30 years and they succeeded. They stacked the court and they got it. And they, I mean, I watched on TV the interviews for those justices and they just lied about Roe v. Wade. They lied. That's all. And then they got the power and they did what they had been put on the court to do, and it got reversed. And so I kind of feel like anything could happen, you know?
Yeah.
I the sense I have, though, is that North America people in general now really feel strongly, not just about the right to choose, or that they don't want a bad law, but they feel like it's women's bodies. You know, they mm-hmm. they really have the norm or the value of bodily integrity, self-determination for one's corporal self, is kind of more the norm now.
Yeah, I didn't think like Riot Girl helped with that. Like the bands that I was talking about today, it was very much about like, this is my body. Like, how dare you?
Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. Yeah, it reframes it. It reframes it. And that gives me hope that if that's really the norm, it'll be much harder anywhere to reverse it. I guess the answer is vigilance always. Because I think what's different now is that if our rights are decreased, it's more of a fascist, neo-fascist, authoritarian, right-wing enterprise than
right.
it was then. Then it was kind of more isolated. It was abortion rights. It was off by itself.
Right.
And now it's not off by itself. And so the success or failure of reversing what you have here depends on making sure that those other elements don't get hegemony, that's all.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess I get what you're saying. It's like if abortion laws are getting reversed here, then there's like also a bunch of other terrible things
yes.
probably happening.
Exactly.
Yeah, because I guess it's become a part of just rising fascist
That's
sentiment.
Right. Yes. And women always have an important place in that, which is back to the kitchen.
Yeah.
I mean, I like kitchens, but...
Broodmares.
Broodmares, kitchens, out of education,
Yeah, I think a lot of women, like, even my generation or some of the students in my class, like, they're really pro-choice, but I don't think we have an understanding of, like, the fear of, you know, we don't know what it's like to not have the choice because
yes.
we were all born after
yes.
1988, right?
Yes.
So
yes.
we don't have an actual emotional sense of how scary it is to feel like you don't have that
yes.
control.
Yes.
And like how different even sexuality would be if we didn't have that.
That's right. That's right. I was speaking to an undergraduate class at Wesleyan that runs a doula program at one of the place Planned Parenthoods where I was working, and I forget what I was even talking about, but mostly answering questions, I think. But it was I think the run up to the first Trump election, and there were a gaggle, maybe four or five young women who were so upset about the possibility of losing Roe v. Wade. They were just crying about how, and I think it hit me. It's like they grew up feeling empowered, that they had that right. They could do it, they could not do it, but And to think about someone taking it away like that, it was like a rape. It was like so awful to them to be violated like that. I really felt for them, but I was glad to see it too, you know, both. So, and now who knows what they're, well, they're probably out in the streets, those gals.
Probably, yeah.
Probably they are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's also just like kind of crazy to think how much later Canada was in guaranteeing that right, because like Roe v. Wade's 1973, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then Canada's not till 1988.
Yeah.
So that's like 15 years.
It's a different trajectory, though. It was somewhat safe under the abortion law, do you know? It was somewhat safe. It was horrible, but it was somewhat protected.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know? So I think that fooled people into a sense of safety about it. I don't think people, and most people didn't know how hard it was to get one.
Right, unless you actually had to go
through. Yes, because you could say, well, we have some limitations, but we have, it's legal.
Mm-hmm.
It's legal in this country. So there was, it was hard to buck that because it was illegal, but it was really horrible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think it's just a different history. It's not just first and second. It really came along in parallel, but in different ways.
Right.
Because the circumstances were different.
And you talked a bit in class about the slogan being choice and kind of how that developed and that there were a lot of arguments. And I know that there was another slogan that the abortion caravan used in 1970, which was free abortion on demand.
Yes.
That then the anti-choice really latched onto that as like a disgusting and immoral thing to want, and like calling it like, oh, you just want abortions for convenience or whatever.
Yes.
But I guess when I think of free abortion on demand, I'm like, oh, that's such a like cool, like socialist thing to want, you know?
Yes.
Do you have any feelings about the changes there?
Yeah. So I think free abortion on demand was an attempt to sloganize the feeling for control of my body.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was really self-determination that it was trying to express. I mean, you can't, self-determination, I don't think so. It's not a good slogan, you know, but I think that slogan was an attempt to capture that. And also to make sure it was accessible so that not just rich women who could fly to Switzerland would have abortions, you know. But it sounded so callous to most people. It did. It just sounded callous. It sounded like it fit into the wrong idea that women use abortion as contraception. They don't. I mean, studies show they don't. I mean, who wants to have an abortion? I mean, if you have any access to alternatives, birth control, you wouldn't do that, and women don't do that. Unless their circumstances are really horrible in terms of access to prevention. But it kind of sounds like free abortion on demand, I'll just get pregnant whenever I want, I'll have an abortion whenever I want, and, you know, it sounds like that. So in terms of choosing slogans, it was a bad one.
Right.
And I think that was part of the, well, let's call it choice. It was that same thing. Let's call it choice. And I mean, that happened kind of before I was involved. I might not have agreed at the time. I was a bit of an iconoclast, but it was the right decision.
Yeah, because I know even some of the pro-choice people were kind of squeamish about free abortion on demand.
That's true. That's true. Well, that's right, because of what it sounds like. But I mean, I wasn't squeamish about it. I thought what I said, which is that it's just another expression of it's my body, you know?
Yeah, I liked it because part of their demand on that was like, tax the corporations, get them to pay for it.
Yeah,
I'm like, yes,
exactly,
yes.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah.
What an amazing idea.
Oh, I know.
We should still do that.
Right. I know. I thought of something I was going to say in the class and I forgot. When making the decision to start being a provider. Can I slide that in?
Yeah, please.
So one of the things I did was I was worried about the impact that might have on my son, who is young. And And I talked to a Dr. Sally Mahood, who's still, she's retired now. I Googled, I'm not in touch with her, in Winnipeg. And she's been active in reproductive rights forever. And we were just at some conference or other together. And I asked her what she thought about, she had kids too, what she thought about the pros and cons and the impact if I did this on Daniel. And she thought about it a little while, and she said, you know, when I was a kid, about Daniel's, about that age, maybe 10, she was a bit older, she was 9 or 10, is when universal health care coverage came to Saskatchewan. And it was a tumultuous period. Most of their doctors walked out. They had no health care. Eventually, they had to get a whole bunch of docs from England in just to provide health care. And in the end, it all sorted itself out. And of course, now not a single party, including conservatives, would ever have a policy to retract universal coverage. But at that time in that first province, it was bad. And she said her mom was a psychiatrist, and she went and did house calls for primary care during this crisis, and the sentiment was so strong that her husband, who was a farmer, I mean big time agricultural farmer, but he rode shotgun in the truck literally to keep her safe while she went house to house giving health primary health care, delivering babies, whatever it was she was doing. And Sally said, you know, that was such a tremendously impactful event in my life, you know, that, and I felt it was really positive. I was frightened. I was frightened for my parents. She never said I didn't really understand, but she just said, I was kind of sorry they were doing it, but it really gave me backbone. It was very important. And that was an important part of my decision. There are people all over who just stand up sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, and do it. That's all. So that was neat.
Were your own parents any kind of inspiration for you in that regard?
No, they worried about me. They thought what I was doing was right. I don't think they really appreciated the risk
right.
quite as much. But in later years when they did, they were proud of me. They supported me. Yeah, they were pro-choice, but they would probably have preferred I led a more peaceful life.
Let me think. Other questions? Are you getting tired?
A little bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
I will wrap it up very soon.
Okay. I'm still good.
I think I'm just the maybe last question I have for this interview is, like, when you were mentoring people in coalition building.
Yes.
Like, what are your tips for coalition building? Like, was this just finding the right people who were sort of already on board? Was there an element of, like, convincing people to take these risks? Or, like, what was that like?
I think it was a little bit of all of that, really. The reminding, I mean, you can have people who think it's a good idea to repeal the law, but who don't really want to talk to their neighbors or their relatives about it because there's so many taboos around it. And having the town halls or just small meetings where people talk about their experiences really helps people normalize the talking about it, using the A word, you know,
mm-hmm.
Talking about being in support of it. When you're just in your own home, going to work and coming back, it's a little harder. So talking to people about having groups where you can share things, and then making a group on, I don't know, in your workplace or in your union or in at the Y, or you want to have something at the Y, tell us. We'll send a speaker who will come and talk about why it's so important to repeal the law. Mm-hmm. But we were in a situation that was good because we weren't talking just about the right to have an abortion. We were talking about how horrible the law was. And that had its own appeal that was way more palatable than just saying abortion on demand. Mm-hmm. But it was just a question. I mean, I learned this all from watching how OCAC did it. I mean, the outreach committee would come and tell its report, and everybody would talk about who they'd talk to and who was kind of maybe worth some more talking and who felt too uncomfortable and wouldn't. And you mean that they were so good at, and they were so focused on the task. And there were a lot of people that came and helped, who would go to a union, women's caucus meeting, and talk to the flight attendants, women's caucus, or talk to, I mean, just everywhere they went. They went, I forget who organized Delco, but they went there. They just went everywhere, and they talked to people. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't, but it worked a lot. So I did kind of the same thing in the meeting I would have as I was going across the country. I would kind of tell them about what I had learned from what OCAC was doing and how they could do that, and it would work. I know not every time, not every place. And it would work to help repeal the law, and if they wanted, it would work to support an illegal clinic.
Right.
Yeah, both.
So was there also, like, it sounds like these women who were willing to tell their own stories,
yes,
of trying to procure an abortion before the law was struck down, like, was it hard to convince them to tell their stories?
No, it was hard to find them, but when you found them, they were eager to help.
Mm-hmm.
Because they'd been hurt by it. They'd been, like, traumatized by them, you know. And some of the methods that were used for illegal abortions when women couldn't, that was the other thing. I mean, the death rate from illegal abortion dropped dramatically after the laws were repealed. Because women who can't get abortion, some of them will continue with their pregnancy, but many others will try to abort themselves. And some can go to an emerge if they have a problem, and some won't and can't. And they die, you know. Mm-hmm. And then they come in bleeding to the emergency room, as I said. But those stories, I almost died. They did this. They didn't explain to me. They sterilized the dilator with a cigarette lighter before they used it on me. They used bleach and said it might or might not work. They put it in my uterus. These were the stories. This is what women were living through.
Mm-hmm.
And the repeal of the law pretty much stopped that. Pretty
right.
much stopped that. I mean, I guess just the only places that still might have continued were in isolated populations, poverty or immigrant groups or people who didn't have access to any health care.
No nearby,
yes,
clinics and things like that.
That's right.
Yeah.
Although, again, like my Newfoundland story, people will go tremendous distances to get access.
Yeah.
Sleep in their car, you know. Just, mm-hmm. Yeah. Women will do what's needed if they decide that's what has to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So my actual last question, could you talk a bit about the abortion tribunals?
Yes.
When those were, what was their significance to the kind of campaign as a whole?
And by the tribunals, you mean the times when women came and told their stories?
Like, yes, those posters that are advertising the abortion tribunals, like,
yes,
what were those?
So there were a lot of them earlier than my involvement. Like the caravan.
Mm.
The caravan was one of those. But the one I remember the most was in Toronto, and I know they happened all over the country. You know, people would come to an OCAC meeting at some point and tell their story. and, you know, somebody would write down their contact name, and we might not never see them again, you know, or they may get involved. People did lots of things, or they might be involved for a little while and then drop away because they have two other kids. Who knows? But there was a little list of people who were known, either they were in the movement or close to the movement or whatever, who had had horrible experiences. And part of the power of the tribunals was never again. It was really never again. And women would tell their stories. I was just listening to the tape you have here in the archive. It was so nice. But I can barely listen to it still. I mean, I know that woman. And she told her story. I remember, I knew her before the tribunal. I remember the tribunal where she told the story. And it's painful. You know, that should never have happened to a person, right? And mm-hmm. And so people who come because they're curious, or because they've been around it, or because they've had similar experiences, or it drew people. You know, it drew the movement people, but it always drew other people. And by doing that, it helped build the movement, and it helped with being able those people to talk about it. You know, that's the biggest thing with something you're not supposed to talk about, is getting people comfortable enough. You can't argue a position if you can't say abortion, you know, if you can't say right. the word. So it did a lot to anger people, to rally people, to make a community of people who supported never having that happen again. You know, the symbol of the coat hanger with the never again, that was very real.
Mm-hmm. We have a lot of buttons of that.
Of that, mm-hmm. yeah. I mean, it was, I don't know, yeah. It was very real because that's really what women did.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what women did who couldn't get abortions and needed them.
Yeah.
And it was horrible, you know. And it was sometimes successful, but it was horrible. And so it was very effective, and it was also it was cathartic for the women. They knew they were helping. It was just good all the way around.
They didn't have to feel that kind of shame.
No.
Yeah.
They almost always had somebody like there right next to them as they were speaking, so they could hold their hand, or there was support for them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it felt very. It was very personal.
Yeah.
It was very moving.
And brave of them to
very brave, very to speak. Very brave. Some wouldn't, I know, but very brave.
Mm-hmm.
But there were others probably, but I wasn't involved. I think I spoke. I think at that one I'm remembering. I think I might have spoken at that one briefly, but I don't remember others. I just know they happened and how important they were.
Right.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to say or mention?
No,
or?
You've done very well at lining up all the questions.
Great.
That's good.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
So we'll